Leonardo da Vinci's career was in a slump in 1492, the year that he was asked to paint the Last Supper on the wall of a church in Milan. Although his artistic genius had been recognized by people close to him, he was a long way from achieving the public recognition he craved, and his failure to complete several important commissions had created the impression that he was difficult to work with. In his new book, Leonardo and the Last Supper, Ross King looks at how Leonardo came to create the painting that finally vaulted him to fame and has even been credited with changing the direction of the history of art. The book is published by Walker, a division of Bloomsbury, and I'm very pleased that it brings Ross King back to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
In a perfect world, Leonardo da Vinci would have been at the top of his career in 1492. He was 42 years old at a time when the average life expectancy was only 40, and hadn't he already painted the Mona Lisa?
The Mona Lisa came about a decade later, or at least he started it a decade later and probably spent the better part of 10 years on it. Reached the age of 40, and as you say, that was the span of years that he might have been expected to live. That was the average age at which a man died in Italy in the 15th century, and he had done it without creating things like the Mona Lisa or the Last Supper that we today, I think, associate him with most closely. I think we tend to think of Leonardo as such a genius, that he could have done anything and that he could have been very precocious and, like Michelangelo, have created great works of art when he was in his 20s, for example. Michelangelo created the Pietà at age 25 and the David at age 29. But Leonardo, pointing at his works from his 20s, had nothing like that that he could show and impress all of Europe with, which is, as you point out, something he very definitely wanted to do.
He'd been commissioned by Ludovico Sforza, the Duke of Milan, to create an enormous bronze sculpture of a horse and rider, as well as to design a tapestry for the King of Portugal. Were those among the projects he failed to complete?
He did. No one knows what happened to the tapestry he was designing. A design for it was seen later in the 16th century. But he just seems not to have got around to actually giving it to the Flemish weavers who would have created it. The Sforza horse is much more complicated. He spent probably 8 to 10 years on this project, which was going to be the largest bronze statue ever cast. It would have put completely into the shade every work of art by the ancients. And Leonardo was well aware of this and was very determined that this was going to be what he was remembered for. And so he spent, as I say, the better part of a decade drawing up plans for it, experimenting with casting techniques, and figuring out how he was going to create this 23-foot-high bronze statue, which was going to be three times larger than life, to commemorate, first of all, the father of Lodovico Sforza, Francesco Sforza, the first Sforza Duke of Milan. But I think more importantly, he was going to commemorate Leonardo da Vinci with it, because it was going to speak to his absolutely unrivaled talents. And as a number of his contemporaries pointed out, that this was absolutely impossible. It was almost a folly. But it tells us much about the tremendous ambition that he had in the 1480s when he was in his 30s and he was working on it. But sadly for him, or possibly fortunately for him, because he probably didn't have the technology to carry it off, but he was not allowed to do it. Historical events, politics intervened in the early 1490s, and war broke out. And in times of war, bronze is valuable for cannons rather than statues, and so it was expropriated from him, his 75 tons of bronze, and it was shipped away to Ferrara to be turned into cannons. And so poor Leonardo lost his opportunity to create the world's greatest work of art.
But didn't he also design cannons and other works and other kinds of arms?
Absolutely. That's one of the ironies, the sad ironies of this situation, because all the while he came to Milan in 1482 when he was 30 years old, and he spent a decade on the horse trying to do it, but also trying to convince Lodovico to let him re-engineer the city of Milan and turn it into a a new streetscape. It was sort of an urban design that he had in mind that Lodovico never quite got around to letting him get involved with. But Leonardo then, as you say, tried to design weapons of mass destruction. And he designed the giant crossbow, a giant cannon, chariots. I'm sure many of your listeners have seen the images of things like his chariots that have scythes attached to the wheels that rotate and will decapitate the enemy as you ride into battle behind the horses. And so when Leonardo really had spent 10 years in Milan waiting for Lodovico to tap him on the shoulder and say, Italy needs you, Milan needs you, go ahead and build these gigantic weapons for me. And then sadly, in 1494, when Italy was at war and the French army came across the Alps with fearsome guns and 30,000 soldiers, Lodovico wasn't the one asked to cast the giant bronze cannons. That commission went elsewhere. And he was given, as I discuss in the book, something that was probably less appealing to him.
Well, didn't he also fail to finish an altarpiece that he'd been hired to design for a chapel in the Palazzo Vecchio? Was it because he put these things on hold because of other commissions, or because he was one of these people who procrastinated getting the important projects done?
I think there were a lot of factors involved, but I think his main problem is, I mean, we talk about helicopter parents today who sort of hover over their children and check on them endlessly, and I think of Leonardo as a helicopter artist who would hover over his works of art on his easel, endlessly tweaking them, experimenting, getting distracted from them, maybe going back a few months later, or else abandoning them altogether. One of his famous quotes is, art is never finished, only abandoned. And you get the feeling that if you commissioned something from Leonardo, you needed to prize it out of his hands, because there was always one more thing he was going to do to it.
Well, did the circumstances of his birth lead him to feel personally abandoned? He was born out of wedlock, the son of a notary. I'm not sure I know very much about his mother. Wasn't she something the equivalent of a slave?
That's right. There is an argument which is reasonably persuasive and tells us maybe as much as we'll ever know about her. There has been speculation by an Italian scholar that his mother was a slave, i.e. she would have come probably from the Black Sea, possibly North Africa, and have been a domestic slave in the household, if not of Leonardo's father and grandfather, one of the neighboring families in Vinci, where he grew up.
Well, considering his genius, she must have had a very high IQ.
Absolutely. It's, there are many frustrating things about Leonardo, and one is that someone who wants to trace the origins of genius would want to know more about his childhood, more about his education, more about the way he was raised. And we know very, very little. And some of the things we know may be mythical, and they may be legends that were made up by his biographers in the 16th century. It's difficult, though, to know if I suspect he didn't feel abandoned. It's very difficult to psychoanalyze him from 500-plus years later. But I suspect he didn't feel abandoned. There's every indication that he was a much-loved child. And, in fact, he was the only child of his father for many years. He was essentially an adult by the time his father had a legitimate child. And so Leonardo had these younger brothers and sisters who, when he was an adult and when he was in Milan, were growing up at the house in Florence. And there's no indication that he was unhappy with his family situation early on in his life. And Freud has done the famous psychoanalytic reading of Leonardo. I think any psychologist today would be very reluctant to take the job of psychoanalyzing a patient about whom he or she knows as little as we know about Leonardo's early personal life.
Well, do we know why he didn't go into the family business and become a notary? He descended from a long line of notaries.
Absolutely, five generations worth. We do know that, a very simple reason. He could not join the Guild of Notaries because he was illegitimate. But as I discuss in the book, And so he couldn't become a priest and he couldn't become a lawyer. And so certain avenues, certain career opportunities were closed to him. And his father seems to have been very willing to let him become an artist, which in those days was not a particularly prestigious occupation because you belonged to a guild that was much lower in rank in the hierarchy of guilds than the Guild of Notaries. Michelangelo, for example, whose father had pretensions to high society, objected very much and, in fact, beat Michelangelo, and Michelangelo wanted to become an artist. There's no indication that Leonardo's father resisted that career path, and he seems to have been the one that took Leonardo to Andrea del Verrocchio, with whom Ser Piero, Leonardo's father, was professionally involved. And said,
well, Verrocchio was a very famous artist and a very important artist, and that, and it, we get some clue as to how great Leonardo was when he was young by some images in Verrocchio paintings that are attributed to Leonardo. But that must have meant that he was considered pretty good to be apprenticed to an artist of that fame.
That's right. Verrocchio had a reputation as the greatest teacher of his generation, the greatest teacher in Italy, in fact. And Leonardo really couldn't have hoped for a better master. Verrocchio wasn't really a painter. I mean, Leonardo came away from his apprenticeship, which was a very long apprenticeship, with Verrocchio, with whom he seems to have very good relations. He came away from his apprenticeship trained up in all sorts of things like bronze casting, sculpting in marble, and certain engineering works. He didn't, however, do a lot of painting with Verrocchio because Verrocchio was first and foremost a sculptor rather than a painter. And he did do some paintings, and as you say, Leonardo did a bit of touching up in them. And it's fairly recently been discovered that Leonardo painted in oil, which is a medium that Verrocchio never used, on a couple of of Verrocchio's paintings in the 1470s.
My guest is Ross King. His book, Leonardo and the Last Supper, it is published by Walker. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Ross King, who has written extensively about the Renaissance. He wrote Brunelleschi's Dome, Michelangelo and the Pope's Ceiling, The Judgment of Paris, Machiavelli's Philosopher of Power, also two novels, and now Leonardo and the Last Supper, which is published by Walker. You sort of suggested earlier that Leonardo didn't really jump at the opportunity to paint the Last Supper. Why not?
Well, the Last Supper was a kind of consolation prize for him. What he wanted to do, as we were discussing, was create this monumental, absolutely colossal bronze equestrian monument. And instead, he was told by Lodovico, I want you to go and paint a wall in a room where a band of friars eat their dinner, i.e., paint a wall in the refectory of Santa Maria della Grazia in Milan, which is a relatively new church that Lodovico had taken, a church and convent that Lodovico had taken under his patronage. And that was going to be, it was a prestigious commission insofar it was a ducal commission and appears to have come from Lodovico, who certainly paid for it, but it was much less conspicuous. The bronze horse would have sat in the center of Milan, probably in the center of the piazza, or else at the gate of the Castello, which was Lodovico's residence. Everyone who came to Milan would have seen it, and in fact, had he finished it, people would have come to Milan just to see it. Instead, he got a job painting, and a painting in what essentially was a private location. And so it was something that wasn't going to be visible to the people of Milan. You would have to be a visiting dignitary, or you'd have to have some strings pulled for you in order to get into the refectory and see what Leonardo was doing there. And I think also, in his heart of hearts, Leonardo didn't want to paint. My theory is that that's why he left Florence in 1482 and came to Milan, because he wanted to reinvent himself and work as a military engineer, making his weapons, or as a civil engineer, redesigning the city of Milan or doing dams and hydraulic engineering and things like that, major public works projects, rather than painting altarpieces. And so I think it was probably with a certain amount of frustration and possibly even anger that he accepted the commission from Lodovico to do a Last Supper in the refectory.
And while he and his crew worked on the Last Supper, another artist, Giovanni Donato de Montofano, was hired to paint a crucifixion on the opposite wall. Now, Montofano is largely forgotten. Was he considered Leonardo's equal at the time?
Probably not. He came from a well-known family of painters in Milan and had certainly been well-trained, and more to the point, well-trained in the art of fresco, which is a technique, a very specific, difficult technique that Leonardo was not trained in. But it seems that Lodovico may well have decided that he was going to concentrate Leonardo's mind on the task at hand by instituting a kind of fresco competition. In some of my other books, I've written about the way in which fresco painting, or painting in general, was a kind of competitive sport in the 15th and 16th centuries, where they actually would pair artists or teams of artists, a patron would pair teams of artists off against one another, in order to get them to rise to greater heights. And that may well have been what Lodovico was trying to do here. He was going to try to inspire Leonardo, first of all, to finish the work. And I think if you were a betting man in 1494, you would not necessarily have wagered the mortgage on Leonardo finishing the work, because if we've been talking about the way in which he abandoned certain works of art, these were works of art that were in oil paint that were 8 feet wide, and suddenly he was given the task of painting a fresco technique that, as I say, he never worked on, that was roughly 30 feet wide by 15 feet high. And so the odds in some ways were very much stacked against him. And so, yes, Montofano may have been brought in to spur Leonardo on, possibly even to provide some kind of technical assistance to him and help him learn about fresco. But if that was the one of the purposes of Montofano, Leonardo would have marched him back to his area, his end of the refectory, because Leonardo, of course, tried something completely different. He didn't paint the Last Supper as a fresco. He came up with an experimental technique, which sadly has proved much less durable than Montofano's fresco.
Well, fresco involved using egg tempera, which then bonded with the fresh plaster and created some kind of a permanent bond. But oil on a fresh plaster is a very bad idea, isn't it? But Leonardo had only painted as an oil painter, even though that was a fairly new technique in Italy.
That's right. Generally, when you did a fresco, you didn't even use egg tempera. You suspended your pigments only in water. You mixed them with water, and you got them onto the wet plaster, and the plaster had to be wet before it dried. And so you had 8, 10, 12 hours to finish your little scene, which is maybe 4 feet wide by 3 feet high. The next day, the plaster would come in, spread another 3 by 4 foot field of plaster, and you would go to work on that. And you had to work with great speed. Leonardo did not work with great speed, and his paintings were created by building up layer upon layer and by smoothing the colors into one another, and by, even by using his fingers on the paintings. Sort of almost doing a kind of finger painting. And so fresco had no appetite for him. Every painting manual of the 15th century, though, told you that if you're going to paint on a wall, use fresco. Do not, if possible, use egg tempera and oil because you'll come unstuck on it, and literally unstuck. And Leonardo, though, had faith in his own technological abilities. He loved oil paint, and he experimented with numerous oils. His notes are full of all sorts of combinations of different kinds of oils. If you were ever in his studio, I would imagine there were pots bubbling everywhere, and he had assistants grinding up pine needles and cracking nuts and grinding them to try to find this holy grail of ingredients that were going to allow him to paint on the wall.
Now, did it look good at the start? Because it started deteriorating fairly soon. But I'd imagine while he was painting it, he thought, this is working quite well.
That's right. It looked, the great tragedy for us is we cannot see what it looked like. But it was absolutely stunning, because no one had ever seen something that large painted in those colors, and also with the kind of nuances that he put into it, with the gestures and expressions. In fresco, as I was describing, you had to paint facial features very, very quickly. You had to get it in the space of a day, and if you went back and wanted to adjust the features, you had to chip off the plaster and do it all over again equally quickly. Leonardo, though, had the luxuriated in the time that he gave himself by painting in this mixture of oil and tempera. And so he, therefore, could work much more slowly, build up his colors, and use much, much brighter colors, because he could use, for example, mineral pigments and very bright reds and blues that were denied to fresco painters because of the action of the lime and the plaster.
So when the thing started falling apart, did the Duke call him back and say, Leonardo, this needs to be fixed up?
Sadly for the Duke, he was away at the time, more specifically in a prison in France. Lodovico only got to enjoy gazing upon Leonardo's mural for about 2 years.
Now, Ross, we have very little time. The painting has been retouched and restored many, many times over the years. Do we have any idea what it really looked like?
We know from early engravings, it was reproduced very widely early on. The earliest engraving comes from 1498, probably the year done within the year of him completing it. And a copy was made by a man named Gian Pietrino about 20 years later. It's now at Oxford University in Magdalen College. Gian Pietrino did a full-scale oil copy of it. Gian Pietrino was an impeccable source for the painting, because he was probably one of Leonardo's assistants in the 1490s.
We have to leave it there. Thank you so much, Ross King.
My
latest book, Leonardo and the Last Supper, it is published by Walker.